This is a HeadGum Podcast.
This week's episode is brought to you in part by Squarespace, the website that helps you make websites. Andrew, why do you want to make a website?
Because I have a lot of ideas that I need to spread across the globe.
Well, Squarespace is ready to help you with your plan for world domination. They can help you showcase your work or promote your online business using beautiful templates created by world-class designers. And if you have any problems, you can take advantage of their 24/7 award-winning customer support. So go to squarespace.com/overdue for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code OVERDUE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace, take over the digital world. I'll just kick us in. Hey, hey.
Good start.
Hey, everybody, welcome to
Okay, go ahead, Craig. Can you... Oh, shoot, sorry.
That's Am I just throwing you guys off your game? I'm sorry.
Hey, everybody,
Craig,
welcome...
Craig, start doing...
Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name's Andrew.
And we have a special guest this week. Who do we have with us this time?
Hi, my name is Kate Reculia, and I'm chuffed to be here.
Oh, yes. Good use of chuffed, Kate. Thanks for joining. I didn't mean to make it like a game show, but seemed appropriate.
It does. It does.
For this week's show. So
you're like a reality TV host, and we have a guest judge this week, and she's going to come out and tell us about herself. Yeah,
that's good. Yes.
Or you're going to have to guess what I do just by some strange details about my life.
Oh, what was that with Summer Sanders? What was that show?
Figure It Out
with Summer Sanders on Nickelodeon. That was a good show.
That is really the most basic name for a game show.
What
should we call this? Figure It Out.
It feels like some kind of conversation between executives that was transcribed wrong, and that's just the filler name they went with.
I watched a kid eat a bowl of cereal out of his concave chest on that show. It was rad. It was super rad. Anywho, they figured it out. They figured out his chest. Anywho, if you've never listened to this show before, one of us or all of us this time read a book that we haven't read before, and we talk about it to each other and to you, the listener. We have asked Kate to join us here for what book, Kate?
For The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin. I didn't realize you guys both read it. This feels very exceptional and exciting.
Yeah.
You got the star treatment.
So I didn't remember if I'd read it, actually. And then I was reading it, and I remembered every single of these wacky names.
Yep.
They were burnt. I didn't remember anything else about it, but I remembered every single name. And I was like, yes, I've definitely read this book.
I've read this book so many times. Every time I reread it, I have that experience, but I found something new this time. The first time I ever was like, what? Oh.
Oh, nice.
That's a sentence I don't remember out of.
And this, we'll get into the book and Raskin's bio proper, Kate, but why is this book special to you, and why might it be notable that we've had you on the show to talk about it?
This book is, it's really hard for me to see. I was trying to think of how I was going to make this metaphor work. I can't see this book for the trees. It's so...
For the trees that it was printed on? Yeah.
Essentially, I read it when I was probably 10 or 11. It's one of the most formative books I remember reading as a young person. And the book just arriving to me and being something kind of that I was ready for, but it was just complex enough to really kick things up a notch in terms of what I understood reading could be, what I thought writing could be, what I thought the world was, all these things. And it's very quirky and full of dumb puns and excuse me. And it's a game involving characters who are all flawed and mostly adults. And I had just never read anything like that at the age of 11. I basically went right from this to Jurassic Park. It's a natural progression. But I just loved it as a kid. And I wrote as a young person too, but the more I write as an adult, in some ways, I feel like I'm always kind of trying to chase the intellectual and emotional high that this book produced in me as a child.
Mm.
So, but yeah, I can't. It's always interesting to go back and reread it and with a new lens. And I'm curious to hear you guys, your opinions on it, to see what parts have aged well, maybe not aged well.
Yeah.
What parts are, what the experience of reading this is like an adult? Because Craig, you didn't read it before.
Never before. I'm very confused.
He's possessed, I think, by the book.
It is
confusions.
A lot.
Because it is. Of course, it's a mystery book. It's a whodunit on several levels.
Yes.
But then also in a couple of spots, it's like a why done it? Like someone mm-hmm. specific has done it, and you know that they did it, but you don't know why it was done.
It's like an existential whodunit with 16 characters written in like this wry, omniscient voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
okay. So this book was published in 1979. It won the Newbery Award. It also won the 78 Boston Globe Horn Book Award, the 1979 Banta Award.
Oh, it was published in 78, actually. It won the 79 awards.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. Good call. Okay. Good call. Yeah. And so, like, first things first, it's published, what, 2 years after the bicentennial?
Yes. It's so rah-rah.
And America factors heavily into this book. in some ways we'll talk about, and I've found some interesting essays about it as a like rumination on melting pot American ideals and whether or not the book even like does a good job honoring her initial thoughts, because it does kind of seem like she just started writing this thing and just like let it go, like she would just see where it took her.
Yeah.
Andrew, what do you know about Ellen Raskin?
I know she was born in 1928, died in 1984. She wrote several books. The most notable, I think, Figs and Phantoms won, or it was a Newbery Honor book in 75.
That
and
book is
this was,
trippy.
Yeah. I haven't read anything else. And I think, as far as I could tell, this was the last major thing that she wrote, right? Is that?
I think so, yeah. Yep.
I believe that's right. Yeah.
But before that, for a lot of years, she was an illustrator, both like an illustrator of books and then like a commercial artist who did dust jackets of books. And I looked around in vain, like the thing you can find everywhere, you know, like the SEO friendly fact that gets copied from biography to biography is that she did 1,000 dust jackets, including the original one, To a Wrinkle in Time.
Yes.
Which is cool, and it's a super neat looking dust jacket, but I tried to look for more, just like, if not a comprehensive list, then at least like a list of highlights, and I just couldn't find anything. It was all just people saying 1,000 Wrinkle in Time, that's the end of our research.
I found she did do a reissue of like a publication of Dylan Thomas's Child's Christmas in Wales, and then her first book was Nothing Ever Happens on My Street, which I think was a picture book.
It is a picture book. It's so clever too. It's about a little kid who sits on a curb and is like, nothing's happening, and in meanwhile in the background, chaos, iterative chaos is happening around him, and he's just like, I don't see it, and like there's all this, like there's houses burning, and then they come and put out the fire, and it's very clever. She also did the illustrations for Westing Game too.
Yeah.
And all of her own books. Yeah.
Including the cover, yeah.
Sorry, did I scoop your intel?
Seems like a cool lady who kind of, I don't know if there's something about like her background as an illustrator or cartoonist that like led to her making the book this type of book. It seems like there's like a, it is linear, but it's like kind of bopping around all over the place. And there's a lot of like parallel scenes, it feels like, where it's like, let's check in on this person, check in on that person. So it's a lot of sketching going on. I don't know.
Well, there's like, for sure, like a controlled chaos to it. And I think that's clearer than anywhere in like the very Arrested Development-esque crowd scenes that have everybody in the same room at the same time.
That's a good touchstone. I like that. I like that. Kate, am I incorrect that you have also done like some cartooning and things?
Yeah. Yeah. My background is in illustration. That's what my undergrad degree is in. So I think also being a young person who came to this book and loved writing and also loved drawing, seeing like, oh, you can maybe do both. Yes. And
sure. what do y'all know about cozy mysteries? Because we would call this a cozy mystery, right?
Yeah, or a locked door mystery. I read this and Agatha Christie's And Then They Were None in very quick succession as a child.
Okay.
And so I guess I could have picked that one also, though that one is a much nastier piece of work. This is generally kind of sweet.
that's the one where the they all get offed one by one.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
It's like they all go out to the island and they don't know how they're connected to each other, but they, of course, they're all connected to each other, like the Westing game. And someone who they don't know if this person's alive or dead or who they are is killing them all in horrible ways one by one and picking them off in the order to which the murderer believes they should suffer the most based on what their crime was that they escaped justice for. So, but there's something mathematical about it. There's something very pleasingly, there's a, like you said, this kind of controlled chaos. There's order to this chaos. And P.D. James, who, it's a great mystery writer, has a theory that mysteries, people turn to cozy mysteries and mysteries in general because it's a story of order being opposed to chaos, right? Like, we know that there is a solution. We know that there is not just senseless violence. We know that someone had a reason for doing this and then they did it. And I think this, again, it's like a murder mystery for children where there is no murder. I guess there's spoilers, right?
Yeah.
There's spoilers. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I also loved Murder, She Wrote. Of course, there are murders in that, but they're so cozy and bloodless. So this was the next.
They're not Dexter.
No. Yeah. No. Please don't ever reboot Murder, She Wrote. It's perfect the way it is.
Oh, man. Yeah, like I went to cozymystery.com like you do.
Sure, that's just, I know that's your first research step when you read anything, is you just type a just loose collection of descriptions into Google, put .com at the end, and then see what happens.
And they, you know, they have like several paragraphs about what it is, but thankfully they've bolded some things on their definition of a cozy mystery page, that it's a fun read that engages the mind. There's often a cozy mystery heroine. The crime solver is usually a woman who is an amateur sleuth of kind. They often casually overhear things at the scene of it. There's lots of casual overhearing and not so casual overhearing in this book.
Yeah, people are dropping eaves all over the place.
Lots of dropping eaves. It is important that the characters are likable, it says, in a series. And I think this book does some interesting things with whether or not we like the characters. They tend to be fast-paced with several twists and turns. I'd agree with that. And it puts emphasis on plots and character development. It's not like an action movie. It's a lot of people having conversations and then coming up with ideas. So it seems like a cozy mystery for kids. Though I think maybe we'll talk throughout as we talk about the plot a bit, like what in this book surprised me that it was a kid's book. Maybe. I don't know. It took some turns.
it's very, there's some extremely adult concepts in this book that was probably the first time that I encountered them. And it was a very safe way to encounter them, I think, you know? Yeah. Mm, yeah.
It is safe.
Like,
yes.
At the very end, I guess, like, we'll get there. We're going to go through the plot. I don't want to jump ahead. I mean, we can talk about the time jump at the end, which is, like, very unusual for a kid's book.
It's very Animal House-y at the end. It does do how all these people end up. So as we're talking about these characters, know that they all have like a place where they
all have buttons on their little stories. There are so few of your bones that you can clean yourself.
It's true. Most of my body's in the way of the other ones. Which ones are you talking about?
So if you want to clean your dirty bones and you don't want to peel your skin and muscles off, what you need is a toothbrush. And that's where Quip comes in. Quip is a toothbrush company that says if you have good habits, you are good. Vis-a-vis toothbrushing, that means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly. Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. Every 30 seconds, it pulses, and you switch to a different quadrant of your inside mouth bones, and you clean those suckers up real good. And the Quip Floss dispenser also comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough, as opposed to too little or too much. Quip delivers a fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. So if you go to getquip.com/overdue right now, you'll get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/overdue. That's spelled getquip.com/overdue. Quip, the Good Habits Company. Do we want to, how do we want to start? Do we just want to start with just a list of characters? Because I think that the book's greatest triumph probably is it does, with a lot of like concision, it does draw like 16 people really fast and makes them like suitably memorable and distinct from one another.
Well, tell me, Andrew, why are they all together? What is the cozy situation in which they find themselves?
So the book opens with this guy. Is it Northrop? Who's
Barnaby Northrop?
Barney Northrop.
He's selling apartments in this building to a group of tenants, and he is just a crackerjack salesman because he manages to sell everybody exactly the apartment that he was trying to sell them.
That their names are already listed.
Yeah,
on the mailbox.
And so these people have been pre-selected to move here, but you're told like right up front some basic things about them.
You're also told that Northrop's not real, right? Isn't that what?
Right. So I think in this.
Yeah, there's no such
really
person as Barney Northrop.
In the,
yeah,
like nothing is as it seems.
Yes.
Pool like pretty fast, but he sells all these pre-selected folks these apartments, but one person doesn't belong here. And then there are a bunch of other people who also do stuff too, right?
It's a lot.
Well, yeah, wait, hold on. I got my copy right here. Yeah. I also would be remiss as like a Westing fan if I didn't say the most iconic first line in children's literature. Mm-hmm. The sun sets in the west. Just about everyone knows that. But Sunset Towers faced east. Strange. Strange. It's like, you know exactly what you're in for. Yeah, they're mothers and fathers and children, a dressmaker, a secretary, an inventor, a doctor, a judge. And oh yes, one was a bookie, one was a burglar, one was a bomber, and one was a mistake.
I was like, what does that line mean when I read it? Like, what is woo?
That turtle, they talk about turtle?
I know who they're talking about.
I was making a joke about her mother's attitude toward her existing through most of this.
So let's do a dramatis personae. We're talking about the Wexler family, Andrew. Who's the Wexler family?
I just talked a lot, so.
Oh, did you though?
We got Jake Wexler, who's a foot doctor, but also a bookie.
That's a secret. Don't tell anyone.
Sorry, it's a secret. Shh.
I like didn't know what a bookie was till I read this book. I still don't think I really know what a bookie is.
The children's.
Thanks.
There's Grace Windsor Wexler, who is you'd quickly find out that she is a would-be heiress and aristocrat, like socialite person. who isn't actually so much.
Would-be interior decorator.
And then there are her children, Angela, who is grown up. She's a young adult. She's had like 1 year of college, but now she's engaged to this intern who is very upfront about introducing himself as a doctor to everybody. And then there's Turtle Wexler, who's a 13-year-old girl, and she's the sort of mischievous black sheep of the family.
She's got like big like punk goth energy, even though I don't think she is a punk goth.
I thought you were going to say Punky Brewster, and I was going to agree with that.
Also that.
Yeah. Proto-punk
goth. Just like running
of.
Around, kicking people in the shins. Like her trademark move is the shin kick.
The old shin kick, yeah.
She will exit scenes going like, oh, I need to kick some shins. And she'll just like leave a room. She's got a trademark braid. Like people have like trademark visual things or you know, crutches, as it were, if we're talking about Sydell Pulaski.
It's a metaphor and a real crutch.
Who is the secretary of like a sausage company? Like, what is it? Is it? It's not like Schultz's, which is big. Like, Schultz's. Sausages are big in Wisconsin, right? Like, that's like a thing. Am I right?
Sausages are big a lot of places, Craig. It's not just Wisconsin that has sausages.
Well, I think the Milwaukee Brewers have like sausages that run around during one of their like inning breaks or their kielbasa.
You're really speaking with authority on this topic. I can tell.
I don't like the Brewers, so I've really kind of blacked it out. Then we have another family. We have the Theodorakis family, which is a Greek family. They own a coffee shop on the first floor. The parents we don't spend a lot of time with. I have trouble remembering who they are and what they do, because as I recall, they don't get invited to the game proper.
Right.
Correct.
Yes. The two sons are Chris and Theo. Theo, who, what, he isn't sure if he's going to go to college. He wants to be a writer.
Yeah, he's like playing with the idea of going to college for writing. But he, like so many like 17, 18-year-olds, does not know what he's going to do yet. But he feels sort of defined by his relationship to his brother, Chris, who has, if I'm remembering correctly, it's not really made medically clear what he's got.
No,
but it's some
it's
kind
very
of
vague. Yeah.
Muscle disease that is serious but curable with just medicine later.
I think by the end of the book it is not completely cured, but like the things that cause him to have seizures are like lessened or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
And tremors,
he is also an avid bird watcher. He is often seen sitting looking out a window with his binoculars, played by Shane West in the movie Get a Clue, which is the movie adaptation of the Westin game from 1997. Shane West from the hit movie, A Walk to Remember. The hit movie, A Walk to Remember.
Shane Westin game over
here. Hey, there it is. Hey,
so those are the two big family units. Who are some of the other individuals who we get to meet through this thing?
We meet the Who's, Mr. and Mrs. Who, who run a Chinese food restaurant on the top floor. No one ever comes up there, which makes Mr. Who very upset.
He picked apparently two like Zhujia neighborhood to have a Chinese restaurant in.
Yes.
Which I find kind of hard to wrap my head around.
I think he's in his 40s and Mrs. Who is like in her 20s or.
She's like 28. Yeah. Because his first wife died.
So she doesn't speak. She's like recently from China, does not speak a lot of English. Is like really hoping she can go away back to China soon. They have a son, Doug, who is a track star who literally spends time in this book training for his track meet by running around the apartment building. Cool, I guess.
That's all that
Doug
does.
He just wants to run and be yelled at by his dad.
Flora Baumbach, who is a dressmaker. Which we like see her in action while she is making Angela's wedding dress. She has lost a daughter, Rosalie, I think was her name. And she, over the course of the game, befriends Turtle, the shin kicker. We have the local judge, Judge Jojo Ford. Is that her name? What's her name? Josie Jo Ford.
JJ Ford.
I don't remember what court she's on at the beginning of the book, but by the end of the book, she's on the Supreme Court. So
she does end up on the Supreme Court.
I would like to live in the Westin
Judge
game
JJ Ford's on the Supreme Court. Mitch McConnell didn't give her a hearing, unfortunately, and so here we are.
Yes.
And
rounding out
our
crew, we have Sandy McSouthers, the eccentric doorman. He has a chipped tooth. Is that Sandy? Yes.
He was a boxer. He was a prize fighter. Yeah, and he was fired from Westing paper products for trying to organize.
True.
I saw that and I said boo.
Well, once we get through this cast, I'll want to mention a historical thing about that. Sorry.
I know, we're still going.
Yeah, sure.
We should also mention that Mr. Who sued the now missing Mr. Westing for stealing his paper diaper invention. So there you go. There's also Bertha Erica Crow, who's a cleaning woman who found religion after some sort of sin that we'll find out about later. And there is Otis Amber, the like late middle-aged delivery boy who everyone thinks is up to maybe he's not as weird as he seems and something is up. I think that's everybody, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I think so. That's a lot.
You mentioned the union busting thing, Andrew. Apparently, Westing is based in part on a dude named John Michael Kohler, who
is the bathtub guy.
The bathtub guy is an Austrian immigrant whose son then went on to make the big bathtub company, started a town sort of like Westing does in this book, and apparently what became the governor of Wisconsin. The crash happened in the early 30s. He lost his governorship. His workers tried to unionize. Strikers were killed. And then a grand jury indicted him for price fixing, and he died a month later. So he was definitely an inspiration to Raskin, as was Howard Hughes, who died not long before this book was written.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, those two dudes inform the central, non-figure of the book, who is Sam Westing. The eccentric bajillionaire who...
Paper magnate, yeah.
Paper magnate.
Industrialist person.
Who has...
Yeah.
Paper baron, who has previously disappeared after,
baron.
An auto accident that left his face all messed up. And then, the inciting incident of the book is that, some people tell some ghost story or something about the Westing estate. Turtle goes in there, maybe with someone else, maybe by herself, I don't remember, and she sees his dead body and gets spooked.
I feel like she's put up to it by Doug, possibly.
Yeah, they it's like Sandy and Otis tell the story, and then Turtle's if you make it, I think it's $2 per minute,
yes.
It's on, I'll go up there and hang out with his corpse. And Doug is with her because he can run the fastest. He's not inside the house. I know this book in my DNA in a way that is very weird.
What is it to read it when that's happening? When you're I don't read books I know. I don't have too many books like that I've read that many times.
Yeah. It's a little remembering instead of reading. But then you stop seeing things, right? So the last time I read it was years ago. It's definitely been a long time. But I've thought about it a lot, and I've written a lot of personal statements to get into graduate school about it. So I've thought about it analytically.
So she finds dead Mr. Westing. I think before that happened, Chris the Birdwatcher had seen someone limping into the estate. She remembers hearing someone say purple waves while she was in there.
Well, and smoke had come out of the chimney, too.
Smoke had come out of the chimney.
Just about everybody noticed. Yeah.
Yep. That's why they started telling the ghost stories.
When white smoke comes out of the chimney of the Westing place, that's how you know they've chosen a new Mr. Westing.
There's a new heir.
And so the next day, they are all summoned to a will reading by Mr. Plum, Mr. E.J. Plum. I think is his name.
Yep. Ed Purple.
And lo and behold, all 16 quote unquote heirs live at this apartment building. And they're all very surprised to find each other there. I think it's Grace Wexler who just really personifies the limousine liberal man, how could all these different people be his heir? I'm not bigoted, but am I? Mm-hmm. She's just kind of a mess of contradictions in a way I found. I could tell Raskin was really working through that stuff where at multiple times in the book, she is the one who is regularly saying some stuff that you're is this in a kid's book? You're talking about how your family cut you off because you married a Jewish guy and you making all sorts of assumptions about people of color who live in this apartment building
just,
with you.
Kind of just smoothly calling people Orientals, which
is
and making comments about everything. But then, especially that scene when she's talking with Jimmy Hu and like saying super racist stuff about his wife, like you flip to Mr. Hu's perspective and he's like, oh great, my partner is a bigot. And that was the first time I had encountered the word bigot like as a kid. I was like, oh yeah, that's gross that she
I
said
also
that.
Cut some like they she doesn't dwell on it a lot, but there's some they even touch really briefly on like skin tone with Judge Ford.
Yes.
Briefly, because she talks about being like lighter skinned and talking about that in relationship to her, like, I don't know, just her life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, because she's black and we find out later in the book that her parents worked for the Westings or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think her mom was a housekeeper and her dad worked for the railroad, but was the gardener and the estate.
Yes. So like we deal with a whole bunch of stuff coming her way. Like I don't remember which character it is that like wonders whether or not she's like a Black Panther or something. It's really just
might be Turtle.
The amazing like third like omniscient narrator in this book just sits on people's shoulder and like listens to their wildest thoughts regularly.
It really does. What
is now we're talking about all the things that these people think about each other, but like the bulk of the book is the time they spend together doing what? What is the Westing game?
So the Westing game is this, first there's this incredibly theatrical will reading, and which describes what the game is, but it's still very kind of obscure what the game actually is. They get partnered. He assigns them to have partners. And they're not, you know, the brothers are split up. Turtle and her sister are split up. So they're partnerships that are kind of unusual.
Yeah, this is very much a wedding where the people want you to make friends so they don't you at a table with
you
anybody.
You can't sit with someone you know.
Yes, you have to. You can't just do that willy-nilly. Ugh.
Unless you're Sam Westing.
Hit a nerve with somebody.
So each partnership... I forget exactly what the money is, but they each get like $10,000 to start, but both partners have to be there to sign the check, and they get a series of like clues, like words or parts of words on Westing paper towel, like printed on Westing paper towel. And they have to like figure out so basically the will implies that Sam Westing has been murdered. He says, my life has been taken from me by one of you. And the game appears to be use these clues to figure out who took my life. There's a lot of supposition and like kind of obfuscation and like lots of sleight of hand that like you really appreciate as an older person reading it. But as a kid, I was just like, who killed him? somebody did it.
He's doing a lot of really risky like shot calling in the prose, like guessing how people are going to react to things.
Yes.
In a way that makes him seem like he's everywhere. Like there's one of the articles where he like tells Grace to sit down just after she's stood up and had some kind of embarrassing outburst.
Yeah. And this is all being read by the lawyer who purports to have never looked at it before. When any of this happens, he is surprised as well. It's sort of unclear what exactly they're even supposed to solve. They're just given clues.
We're supposed to solve who killed him, right?
No, but like it is unclear how the puzzle is supposed to work. Like it is very much an escape room in the sense that like here is stuff. It means something.
Figure it out. Yeah.
Part of the puzzle is figuring out how the puzzle works.
Yep.
I think they are given a direction that like you can't solve it with your clues alone.
What you don't have, not what you have.
Yes.
Or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. It's not what you have. It's what you don't have.
Everybody has like words or snippets of words, as you said, Kate. So some folks are like, is it the stock market? Like Turtle and Floor are like, oh, it's clearly a bunch of stock market letters.
I was kind of frustrated because everybody, I don't know. Like, so some people, right, they overhear every team of two people gets like four words, right? And some folks either see or overhear or sort of infer some of the words that other people have. And I feel like the rules like laid out in the will make it fairly clear that no one team has got everything they need
right.
to solve the puzzle.
I
and
thought
yet,
that too, yeah.
Everybody, every single team believes that by chopping and screwing their four words in a specific way, they can solve the whole puzzle.
It is. I mean, what is capitalism but like false competition? Like, and I think
it's giving people four words, expecting them to solve a thing, and then blaming
right.
them when they can't do
when they can't like work together to do something. Because I think it's Theo who's like, it's not what you have, it's what you don't have. So why don't we put everything together? But everyone, all the teams are just too suspicious to collaborate at first, and then there would be
yeah.
no book. But
yeah. What like
that's
Siddell...
true. There is at a certain point you get to a place where there is conflict because if there isn't any, then there's no
right.
There's no book. Yeah.
So. Then we pulled our clues and we solved it. And also, like, clearly the clues are America the Beautiful, which I as an adult see right away.
Yeah, I also yes. as an adult yep. saw it right away.
Yeah.
And then also, I feel like somebody would pretty much instantly be like, "Man, all these people have cardinal direction last names. That's
yes.
that's
what's
funny.
That about?" But I mean, so many of the names are so. Like goofy sounding, like you can just sort of make a case that like she's making a joke. You're like, oh no, that's actually a clue. That's not
sure,
just her making a joke. But yeah, so they go their own ways and they go back to the apartment building and they're snowed in. There's a snowstorm, conveniently.
Yeah, very very well done on the snowstorm. He couldn't
Indeed.
Have planned on the snowstorm, but
or
did
could he have? Is he one of those liberals who controls the weather?
The weather.
I don't think Sam Westing is a liberal necessarily.
No.
What did she? I found a quote from her Newbery speech. She said about the book something to the effect of, oh, I almost outwitted myself. My tribute to American labor history ended up a comedy in praise of capitalism. Just an amazing,
whoops,
incredibly self-aware thing to say about your book.
Whoops.
Yeah, I mean, and like the things that I took away from this book were not yay capitalism. Like, I remember I love Turtle. She's a great heroine. But like the fact that she buys stock, I was like, that's dumb. Like, I did the yes. stock market game in fifth grade. And everyone, of course, wanted to buy Disney because it was like right after The Little Mermaid came out. And I was like, this is dumb. Like, this game is dumb. Like, I don't want to.
So,
but anyway.
What's so frustrating about the Turtle stock stuff to me reading it was like, I know it's not the answer. Like,
right.
they seize on some line that either Flora remembers or they get from Siddell's like handwritten notes of the reading, I don't remember, where it's like, oh, you have to like make more of your money. It's yep. some line that they talk about. Is it Shakespeare? Is it the Bible? I don't remember what it is.
May God thy gold refine.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep. Yep.
And so
and
there
it just says buy Westing paper products at the end. And so that kind of casts a capitalist pall over the rest of the directives.
So like you're watching that and you're like, oh, this is interesting. But the most interesting thing about Turtle's plot is like her relationship with Flora and how she gets to have like a mother that she never had. And
yep, who just loves her unconditionally.
Unconditionally.
Which Grace cannot
yeah.
do. Yep. And her relationship with Angela. Like
yes.
Angela, reading Angela as an adult, I see what I took from her as a kid. And even, I mean, I read this book in probably 1990, 1991. It was already like a dozen years old. And it still felt like this is a book written about another time. Mm. But Angela is sort of like, I don't have an identity outside of I'm getting married. And her mother is extremely domineering and she's very beautiful and she's just trapped. And she becomes this like bomber who
yes.
like sets off bombs around during the snowstorm, sets off a bomb in the diner downstairs, sets off a bomb upstairs in the restaurant, the Chinese restaurant, and sets off a bomb at her own
wedding shower.
Face. Wedding shower, yes. And in trying to like, because in trying to save Turtle from getting hurt, she ends up getting hurt herself. And then Turtle later, because she knows Angela has done this, and she just doesn't want to crush her mother, and also doesn't want Angela to like, Angela's an adult, she'll go to jail. She sets off her own false bomb. And like that kind of, so the thing that I noticed this time that I had never picked before, when Judge Ford sort of figures out this complication and what all has happened, she's like, it's some great line about, hold on.
A time code, Craig?
Yeah, I got a time code.
Like she had never wanted a sister before that moment. And I was like, oh, That's such a nice feeling. Yeah. Just like a...
Well, and just thank God that Turtle is more mature than Grace is through most of his... Like, I think Grace gets to a better place gradually, kind of.
Okay, let's talk about Grace's arc for a second, because it ends in an amazing pun, which is just bad, but also great, where she, I guess to, like, just spend... Because she's partnered with Mr. Who, and so she starts spending a lot of time with him, and then just starts working in his failing restaurant and is like, well, what if we spent some of our money on your restaurant? Let's rebrand it as Who's on First. And he's like, that's confusing. We're not on First Avenue. And she's like, no, it'll be great. We'll fill it with sports memorabilia. It'll be wonderful. And then by the end of the book, she's like franchised it into multiple restaurants, which is just like, what? And like the fact that like, she develops this relationship with Mr. Who, like, teaches her about her relationship with her own husband. It seems like a bad marriage, and then by the end, I guess they're okay, right?
Well, okay, so let's talk about Jake for 2 seconds. The only thing I want to talk about with Jake is that he's a podiatrist
bookie
dad. Yep. Because when they are filling out whatever forms they submit, like before the game starts, there's a field that says position in it. In the first part of the book, it's just like, this is how the characters see themselves. And then in the last part of the book, it comes up again. And it's like, well, this is how me, the omniscient Mr. Westing, sees you all. And it's how you all truly are. But for position, Jake Wexler writes initially, standing or sitting when not lying down.
That's so good.
And it's just kind of a dad joke goat.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It really is.
It's a good one.
Yeah, and that's also the first thing Angela says for her position, none. But in the omniscient narrator, we understand how her fiancé heard it as N-U-N instead of N-O-N-E.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. It greatly concerned him.
Yes, he's like, what?
But yeah, right after you get that Jake Wexler standing or sitting when not lying down, like the very next line is Grace Wexler did not understand her husband's joke about position. And that tells me all I need to know about that marriage.
That's so true. Know? But yeah. Also, like, I mean, this is a book for 10 and 11 year olds. It's about this marriage. Like, how many books are there about? And maybe I loved it, especially because I was an only child. And I mean, I had friends, but like the peers I related to were my teachers and my parents and like older people, and this definitely kid pitched access into the interior, imperfect lives of adults was just
And that it is. I was impressed. I think I found it confusing at times because she is very economical in her language. Sometimes in the way that she will just switch perspective, or she will just like hop between dialogue very like with a lot of agility and very quickly at times, because she's just like, there are 16 people that matter and I'm just gonna make sure they all get equal time almost, which that to me was surprising, coming in being like, we're gonna read this cool like cozy mystery for like middle school age readers. And then to really not have a central character until like the last third of the book, and not have it be a 12-year-old, not have it be all through the eyes of the age of someone reading it, you know?
Yeah, I think like a more conventional version of this book is Turtle is one of the main characters anyway, but would have the book like through her eyes pretty much exclusively. And so much of the mystery would probably come from her just not fully understanding adult stuff yet.
As opposed to everyone not understanding it.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And I haven't seen the movie because I'm sure it's terrible.
Yes, sorry, I'm sure.
But I'm sure the movie is like that. I'm sure it's very much through Turtle's point of view, and she's probably a little more of like a Jessica Fletcher character. And the point of Turtle is that she is so angry and so underloved by someone she desperately wants to be loved by, that she can't be that character until the end, until she gets, you know, the support from Flora and does this thing for her sister, and she has to change. Like, everybody changes in ways that, big and small and significant ways too, even if it's a small change.
Yes.
But I think underloved might be the saddest thing I've ever
heard. Yeah, right?
But she is.
No, she is. That's an that's an excellent description. It's just a sad combination of words that you did.
Yeah, it really is a shame.
Well, it's so, I literally just finished reading the book today again for the, so it's super fresh, but like Grace is just so cruel to her, like, and so dismissive.
She really stinks.
And so, and Jake's a good dad. He makes, you know, goat dad jokes and like is always like, but our daughter, you know, who is 13, shouldn't sleep in this closet. And Grace is like, it's fine, it's fine. And then, of course, when she becomes, you know, like this radiant young woman, Grace is like, my daughter's wonderful. She's right over there.
Yeah, like once she's all that herself and it becomes clear, no longer is she a plain ragamuffin, but she's a beautiful young woman who knows how to play the stock market. Then she is,
then she is
worthy of love.
And I mean, Grace does, like when she gets more authority and autonomy, I guess, to like do things and be successful, that sort of makes some of her. And I love also, like, she's drunk. Like, there's this like long sequence where she and Jake go and reconnect, and she gets completely smashed and goes to the
reconnect.
Second.
There's a couple, and that's one of the many like really loopy party scenes that Andrew alluded to earlier, where it's just like we've come up with a reason to shove at least half of the cast into a room together. And they're all just like going bonkers, and Grace is like falling down, like misses a chair. It's done with like two lines. Like if there were three main characters as opposed to 16, it would be like a 2-page thing about the fact that she fell down. And it's literally like she missed the chair. They helped her back up, and then they kept talking.
Like, it's like slapstick. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the puns and the jokes, and it just like comes at you. And I think also reading it as a young child, like this book just expects you to keep up. There are no training wheels. It's just like, here you go. Enjoy.
I think I was not properly calibrated for that, which gave me a little bit of trouble getting going with it. I was thankful for the Judge Ford like arc.
Yes.
That was largely about just literally solving the mystery of like, when she's like, I'm a judge, and she's like hires the private investigator, who may or may not be a real private investigator, doesn't matter. And
I love this book.
like starts actually like getting information on all of the main characters. That is the closest it feels like to a conventional mystery.
Yes. Yeah.
Where, oh, here is someone's like actual backstory about why they may or may not like Mr. Westing. Oh, here's information on how they may or may not be related to the fact that Mr. Westing's daughter died the day before her wedding, that we don't know where his wife is. All that stuff is like revealed through the Ford thing, while the other characters are like trying to solve their mysteries, trying to solve their personal lives, and the bomber starts happening. So that there's like a second mystery going on to kind of distract from the fact that Raskin isn't really interested in solving the central mystery for a few pages, which is actually really clever. That she's like created a mini arc character mystery out of the whole bombing stuff, mm-hmm. that sufficiently takes center stage while Ford is just doing like conventional detective work that's less exciting and less in the vein of the rest of the book. But that like gets you to the end where things start getting revealed and people are accused of things and then not accused of things.
And it just evolves into like a full on like To Kill a Mockingbird
court scene
with Turtle as a lawyer
flawlessly imitating
everyone she's ever seen on TV. Yeah.
She likes how it feels when she switches her head around. It feels very grown up.
Yeah, that's a very cute character tick. Yeah,
and like revealing who different people were and whose secret identities are. I think that's a big part of the book too, which is interesting because it's so much about this diverse group of characters and their different identities, where they come from, kind of what defines them and what separates them. But then almost all of them have like another secret part of themselves behind that, or they're like using the superficial elements of their ethnicity or their background or what they do all day. And meanwhile, they've got a whole other story going on. And that's like, I don't know. That's, to me, that is like the heart of the book next to who's going to get that paper.
Yeah,
both
no.
the literal paper and the money paper.
That's exactly it. And I think that is what most influences my own writing about it from this book. This, like you said, solving your mysteries, solving your personal lives. Nobody is only one thing. Everybody has a story that they either aren't telling or haven't accepted or haven't figured out about themselves. And everyone, I also just get the feeling, even though Grace is not, like, someone like Grace is a complete mess and Raskin is not letting her off the hook for, like, when she says, like, crazy racist things, like, I think Raskin still, like, loves her.
Like, oh, yeah.
She just has,
like... Like, there is a clear desire there and a direction in her arc to, like, find redemption for her and let her end up in a place where she and the people around her are happy, which did not have to happen.
Exactly.
Like, Grace could be a laughing stock and she loses everything and it's, haha, it's funny because she's terrible.
Yeah.
But that's not how she plays it.
Yeah. No, she's just, like, there's just a warmth and an affection for all of these, like, imperfect people who are stuck in this place together that I love that. That's what I like to write about. I like to write about who people are, who they act like, who they pretend to be, who they want to be, who they are, all that tension, all that mystery.
Well,
thanks, Ellen Raskin.
You've been talking about your writing, Kate. Do you want to tell us a little bit more?
So I am a novelist. I've written 3 books. My third book, well, I've written way more than that. I've published 3 books. If we literally go back to, if I had thought of it, I mean, it's on a podcast. It wouldn't matter if I showed, you wouldn't see it, listeners at home. But the first book I ever wrote, I wrote when I was 13, is called Playing the Game. And it is even more of a ripoff of The Westing Game than my most recent book.
Playing the Game.
Which,
not even a subtle like title change.
And you know what the game is? The game is life. Like, not Parker Brothers' Whoa. Life. The life Whoa. That you live.
The actual game.
The actual game.
Sure. It just blew my mind. Oof.
So, yeah, 13. Turtle's age. But yeah, my most recent book that came out in October is called Tuesday Mooney Talks to Ghosts. And it is very much built on this kind of a treasure, like kooky rich person dies and leaves behind, instead of this kind of game where the heirs have to figure something out. It's more like, I've set a game in the city of Boston. Anyone can play it and you will get a portion of my wealth. And I find it so funny, though, because yes, that book is absolutely indebted to The Westing Game. But my second book, Bellwether Rhapsody, was much more intentionally indebted to The Westing Game, because it is about pairs of people connecting outside of their own experiences and discovering the new layers of their identity in this sort of like, it's about teenage musicians at a weekend like music retreat stuck there while there's a snowstorm. So, and like, maybe someone was murdered. So it's like that pressure cooker, like, locked room mystery experience. So that was like, I think of that as my Westing book, as I think of Tuesday as my Indiana Jones book. But also, like, I can't not write The Westing Game, even if I'm not trying to write The Westing Game.
Sure.
But
well,
yeah,
you've got like 16 characters to be inspired by. Like,
oh my
you
God.
Just take any one of them and write a book about them.
Yes, you could.
And it would probably be interesting.
I like my hat is off to her. Like, I just, the complexity of who these people are, how economically she creates them. And it does look like she just sort of like started and kept going, but it all fits. So like, either did that like amazingly, like as she was going, or she went back and revised stuff. But it's a clock. Like, it's a perfect clock. There's nothing that doesn't fit in it. And I will probably always be trying to write something that tight and not succeeding.
Yeah. Do you find yourself like putting that impulse aside because you're like, here's the characters that I decided to write about and I love them and it's fine and I won't write a perfect like watch that ticks exactly as I need it to?
I think because like what you said, like that the perfect watch, I like am very impressed by it, but that's not what I care about either. Like, I care about the people who are stuck in the gears and like what they're gonna do. But I do also, because I was raised on The Westing Game, there needs to be a feeling of satisfaction. And the ending of this book is one of the most satisfying endings I'd also never read. So they solve, do we want to tell people what the solution of The Westing Game is?
think the book came out 32 years ago or longer than that. I don't know how to do math. I think we're past the spoiler window.
42 years ago.
Yeah, even better. Yes.
Gee whiz.
A long time ago.
So, but anyway, point being, yeah, people, they're fine. They're going to be fine.
They're fine. So the solution is that, I don't know, how do we back into this?
Well, she's doing the trial, right? Yeah.
The solution is that he's not dead.
Yes.
Westing isn't. Not really.
That his life was taken not by killing him, but he took on another identity, and he is one of the heirs who pretends to die dramatically.
Also true.
During the will reading. He's Sandy McSouthers, the doorman, who was the judge's partner, who she didn't investigate. So... That was her only error.
Seems like a blind spot to me. Yeah. The judge kind of realizes it, but doesn't like do anything with that feeling. So that's, I don't know if it counts or not.
He was also Barnaby Northrop.
Yes. And
And Turtle realizes this because Sandy's got, like, as he lies dying, to name another book, I guess, he has a bruise on his shin, which is a trademark, you know, sign of an encounter with Turtle. But he knows that she wouldn't have kicked her friend. She kicked this idiot Northrop earlier.
Yes.
And so she puts two and two together as she's doing this like courtroom drama thing.
But she doesn't tell anyone. She just keeps that knowledge to herself.
She doesn't tell anyone else. Yep. No, because at this point it's very much, it's like, what if the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie ended with Willy Wonka saying, "You get nothing, you lose," and then the movie was over. Yes. Like, everybody has lost the Westing game at this point.
They have all won the idea that they can accomplish more than they thought they could, Andrew. That's what they have won.
Yes.
Then they've all learned that the real $200 million was the friends we made along the way. That's fine.
That's so true.
It's all emotional capitalism.
Yes.
They're never actually going to move up otherwise, but they're going to live in this apartment forever.
Well,
together.
They get the apartment. They get to the split of the deed.
That's true.
Get the apartment. So they get that asset.
So they can move out and then like raise the rents on whoever moves in.
This is getting more depressing by the moment. But
Turtle does win.
Yes.
How so?
So she's figured out that when they're reading the will, the specific instruction is that the one who wins the windfall will be the one who finds the... And then Sandy makes a joke about something. So Sidel, who's taking shorthand notes of the will, misses the word. But there was never a word there because that paragraph was leading into the fourth section of the will. So the actual instruction is the one who wins the windfall will be the one who finds the fourth. And the fourth is the fourth identity of Windy Windklopple, which was Sam Westing's name that he changed.
Yes.
So Sam Westing, Barney Northrop, Sandy McSouthers, and Julian R. Eastman, Kodak shout out.
Who's the guy? We haven't talked about him in our summary, but you encounter him super briefly early on because he's like the chairman of the board or whatever of the Westing paper company.
Mm-hmm.
Like
he's
a guy who's still around even though Westing has kind of disappeared from public life.
He makes statements about how cool Westing was and is like in the paper talking about stocks and stuff. So Turtle has become aware of him.
And she just like goes to see him the next day and is like, "Hey Sandy, I won." And it's her friend who has won all these people. And then the book does this unbelievable thing in an epilogue where it jumps ahead a couple months and then 5 years and then to some indeterminate time in the future when Turtle is like an adult woman married to Theo and some people are dead.
It is strange that they just made some people be dead.
Yeah, I mean, but it makes sense. And again, like as a kid, like I was like reading it today and crying. I'm like, life passes and it's so brief and fleeting and beautiful. like, I'm such an easy mark for that kind of stuff because of this book. So like, but that it's the first book I read as a kid that was like, grown-ups don't know any more than you do, but like growing up is pretty okay. Like you will.
And then everybody dies.
So like, and it's like, and you see what happened to people and like Doug becomes an Olympic runner and like, what else happens?
Well, yeah, Grace opens all those restaurants. Yep. I don't remember.
Mrs. Who and Mr. Who, they start selling these like paper insoles that he had been developing.
And they
become really rich, and she learns how to speak perfect English and also manage the business. And she goes back to China eventually, but it comes back.
And Mr. Who dies, and Otis and Crow die.
Chris goes off to college. I don't remember what he does after
that. He gets married, and he and his wife are ornithologists. They're professors of ornithology.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Judge Ford ends up on the Supreme Court, like we said. There are two separate time jumps, like we mentioned. And in the first one, it's like, now she's on a court of appeals. And then after that, she's on the Supreme Court. And I really appreciate Raskin's, like, dedication to accurately reflecting sort of the hierarchy of the judicial system.
Yes.
I feel like, who are we forgetting? Oh, Jake Wexler becomes like some kind of like crime commissioner for the state.
Yes, because he's an expert bookie, he gets hired to oversee bookie crimes or something. It's like, okay.
It's like Frank Abagnale. You hire the best.
And the crappy, full of himself doctor, like, he and Angela don't get married for a while, and then the implication is that he grows as a person, and then they do end
and
up
she's
well,
a doctor.
She becomes a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, right. And she also, she goes back to college. She doesn't want to be defined by her relationship to this guy anymore. But then once she is on that path, she comes back and finds that she has feelings for him after all. And so they get married and have a kid.
Yes.
Whose name, I think, is Alice, which is what... I can only think of Baba, which is what Flora Baumbach, the dressmaker, called Turtle, even though it's neither her fake name nor her real name.
True.
It's
true.
Turtle trying to self-define, just call me Alice. And yeah, and then the book ends with Turtle being T.R. Wexler, being, I forget where she kind of is in the Westing Paper Products hierarchy, but she's on track to be...
She's their legal counsel.
Yeah, she's on track to be...
And she's on track to be
chair of the board. Yeah. And it's her playing chess with Alice. It's a very, like, circle of life, lifting Simba into the sky kind of ending. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. It's a fun book.
It's a lot going on in it. And it's really... Again, like, I can't separate it from what my brain is and kind of the way that I think about writing and the way that I think about community and the way that I think about everyone you meet. There's so much more to them. Like, there's just, like, everyone has their own story.
Yeah. Well, that's the Westing game. Thanks for playing.
I think about that sometimes, and I can't, my brain will break if I think about it too much.
What?
Like that, like just passing somebody on the street. Yeah. Like they got their own whole thing going on.
Yeah, man.
And I just don't, I'll never have time for it, but I'm glad they've got it.
Do you think, what if that person was looking at you at the exact moment being like, that guy's got his whole own thing going on? And I'll never know.
I would love if somebody else looked at me and thought that I had stuff going on. I think that was great.
I mean, these are thoughts, like, I grew up in Syracuse, which is a relatively small city, suburban town, and then I lived in Boston for a long time. And being on public transportation, it's just like makes you see the world in a completely different way every day.
I saw a guy.
And there's so many. Public transit is interesting because sometimes you bond over with strangers over problematic passengers.
Yes.
And that sort of creates, Susanna really likes that. That creates a sense of like social solidarity that doesn't exist anywhere
else. Yeah, the we're all on this bus together energy that is similar to the ending community of the Westing game folks is a feeling I like to cultivate.
I wish we weren't on this bus together under these circumstances, but we all are, and it's gonna be okay.
Yep.
It's gonna be okay.
Yep. We're on this bus.
Well, this was okay too, in a good way. Folks at home, if you too have played or solved the Westing game, you can tell us your answers at overduepod@gmail.com or hit us up online, twitter.com/overduepod. Andrew, hit up the website real quick.
Overduepodcast.com.
There's lots of stuff there. But Kate, where can folks find out about Tuesday Mooney Talks to Ghosts and other books that you have written? They're just the ones that you've published,
yes.
I guess.
Yes, like the one that's in three spiral bound notebooks playing the game. It's all handwritten and very large printing. That, do you ever, like, as a kid, like the writing that you did that like made the paper crinkle you press so hard? It's like that.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, yeah. Anyway, my books are available from any fine retailer. I would recommend going to your favorite indie bookstore. My favorite indie bookstore is called Let's Play Books. It's based in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. You can go to my website. It's katerakulia.com, KateRaculia.com. And that's also my Twitter handle, at katerakulia. I'm on Instagram at gomezrak with lots of pictures of my cats, if that is your thing.
That's an Instagram thing,
it is,
for sure.
It is.
Well, thanks for being here.
Oh, my gosh.
And thanks for talking to us about one of your favorite
books.
Thank
you so much for having me. It was a blast.
Yeah. It's stupid that it took this long to happen, but now you're
Yay!
Here.
Forever.
Say it like that. Never leaving. We're in this bus and in this Sunset Towers apartment
building. We've been snowed in this house, a snowstorm of my own design, and now at the end of this podcast, I can finally tell you that I've been murdered and... Somebody on this podcast did it.
Oh, no.
It wasn't me.
Oh,
and we all have to solve the murder most foul.
Capitalism.
Andrew's gone away.
I've written words, four words from the song All Star by Smash Mouth on paper towels. And the two of you have to figure out the mystery from that.
Great.
That's amazing.
What do you say? Yep. Andrew, end the episode. Get us out of here.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening. Try to be happy. Bye.
Bye.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.